Hey, come on in, and welcome to Entrepreneurs Can Party. Let me show you around. This is an entrepreneurship podcast for business owners, entrepreneurs, creatives, and those aspiring to be so. The aim is to introduce you to inspiring, like-minded people who are doing what they love every single day and are having so much fun in the process. You see, business can and should be fun. You'll have the opportunity to hear their stories, be given tools and advice to succeed, and to taste what is possible when you think and dream bigger. Me? I'm your host, Scott Stockdale, and I'll be learning just as much as you as I show you around. It's my job as a fellow entrepreneur to tease out their habits, routines, successes, failures, favourite resources, books, etc, etc. All that good stuff. Alrighty, make yourself at home, grab yourself a drink, and let's get this party started. Hey, hey, welcome to episode 132 of Entrepreneurs Can Party. I'm your host, Scott, and on today's show, I'm joined by Kieran Miles at Kieran_Miles_ on Instagram. There'll be a link to that in the show notes. He is one of the co-founders of Duco, a premium sportswear manufacturer creating high-performance garments from ocean waste. The idea was born in 2016, and with their mission of climbing higher, Duco has gone from strength to strength. Despite the inevitable changes Brexit and COVID have thrown up, they've positioned themselves into helping other brands bring sustainable products to life with their certified supply chain, and they've got some really exciting plans for the rest of 2021. I should add, this is one of the most fun conversations I've ever had on the podcast. Kieran's entrepreneurial past is fascinating, and we unpick stories from starting a DJ business at 13 to attempting to pull off his very own festival. Luckily, not a fire festival situation. He's also brought mobile apps to life and has helped to sell wind turbine blades, of all things. In our wide-ranging conversation, we discuss how he grew a night event to be the biggest in the east of England, how to create a clothing brand from scratch, manufacturing processes, and so much more. So without further ado, it's a pleasure to be able to welcome you to the wonderful Kieran Miles. So hey, Kieran, welcome to the show.
Hey, Scott. Thanks for having me.
My absolute pleasure. So much to try and cram in today. So Duco, I better check I've said that correctly. Duco.
Duco is the way that I kind of normally go with it. Means I lead in Latin.
Ah, okay, nice. That was one of my questions, so we've already ticked that one off. No, not at all. That's a good thing. Two birds, one stone. So yeah, you are helping turn ocean waste into clothes, which I think is a fantastic mission, and a premium sportswear manufacturer creating high-performance garments, like I said, from ocean waste. So all of that to cover and so much more, because you have a very entrepreneurial past, which I'm very intrigued about. Before we jump into all of that, though, question I like to ask all my guests, do you have a party trick or hidden talent that people might not be aware of?
I remember this, making notes on this, and I genuinely can't think that I do. I'd probably turn to humour quite quickly in sort of awkward situations. So I think the only thing that I would probably do is tell jokes, maybe. But I can't say they'd be bad. They'd be good jokes. They'd possibly be bad. But I'd probably be more of a joker than I am.
Yeah, no, I do like a good joke anyway. I'm not even going to put you on the spot and try and get you to name one, because jokes are one of those things where you can never think of one when you need to think of one, in my experience. But I thought you might have mentioned, so something I was actually really keen to dig into when I was doing some research for this, your solar, I'm just going to say it and you probably know where I'm going with this, Solar Sand Mobile Disco. How old were you when you started this little enterprise?
Wow, you've definitely done your research. So Solar Sound Mobile Disco was my business at 13 years old. The story behind it was I came from a holiday with my parents. Well, obviously, because I was 12 years old at the time. I was on a holiday by myself at that point. But I went on holiday with my parents, and we basically went to a hotel. There was a DJ and they were playing music, and I just fell in love with the experience of it. I enjoyed it all. There was a karaoke. I did find myself doing karaoke at Celebration. Cool in the Gang was my song. And from there, the DJ was sort of showing me the equipment, and I just enjoyed it. So I came back from the holiday, I turned 13, and I wanted to be a DJ. I had my CD player from my bedroom, my parents' CD player from the living room, and I would just mix songs using the volume controls. And I just loved it. You know, I loved what it was, put one CD in, put another CD in, mix them, nothing too crazy. But it was from there that I then decided, okay, well, you know, I want some disco lights. And I kind of invested in a microphone and a mixer and that type of stuff for Christmas. And then a friend of the family asked if I would, you know, I'd like to just do the music at the New Year's Eve party they were having just in their sort of conservatory. And, you know, I was 13-year-old and it was just bring two CD players, and they were entertaining my enjoyment of the, you know, my and they passed a hat around. I had £90 at the end of the night in sort of tips.
Wow.
So as a 13-year-old and you receive £90 from something you've enjoyed doing like this, that was it for me. I was like, okay, well, I'm going to do this. This is what's going to happen. And I think I DJed at a couple of other parties. I invested in some new equipment, bigger speakers, kind of a more full-on setup with mixing and decks and, you know, the works. And I was doing that all the way through to sort of 16, 17. I think my big claim to fame as a DJ was going back to my previous middle school and DJing as the school party. So you used to have a end of term sort of miniature prom. But yeah, I kind of, my big claim to fame wasn't Ibiza. It was going back to my old high school and also my old middle school and doing the school party. But great research.
That's amazing. I've got so many questions on this because I actually had an interest in DJing fairly recently. It was probably a couple of years ago, and I got all the decks. I went, did a few lessons in Leeds and, you know, really got into it. And your setup, when you said you got two CD players, so I'm imagining like the old school, they're like those big circular things that you just literally pop a CD into and then turn the knobs on the dials and you do it old fashioned like that.
It was exactly that. I was just thinking, I don't know where it is, but I have a photo. I have a few photos, but I have a photo of my Solar Sound setup. So I will, I'll share that with you, so you can see what it was like.
I'm ahead of you, mate. I've already seen the photo somewhere. I think it was on your website, maybe. I was going to put a link to it in the show notes. It's fantastic.
Wow, that is a throwback right there. That is a throwback.
And it did look like, yeah, you said you've invested in some kit. So when you say mixers as well, was that one of those like DJ things with those discs, spinny things on it, and then you were doing all that shuffling kind of things? Or was it, yeah, what did that look like?
I had two vinyl players, record players. And then I also had CDJs, which were sort of like the CD versions of them.
Mm-hmm.
And I then had the mini disc. Well, sorry, not the mini disc. I can't remember the name of it now, but it was essentially the MP3 version where you would attach it into a laptop and you had a small controller, like a MIDI controller, I think it was called, maybe. Yeah, so then you would just mix from music you would sort of download or you would burn onto your computer. Gosh, yeah, I remember the days of burning CDs and things. Yeah. Wow, I haven't thought about that for years.
It's crazy. It is. I was just thinking LimeWire. That just popped through my head then randomly. I didn't
know. Oh my gosh. The days of LimeWire I don't know how old I was at that point. Wow. I haven't thought about these things for so long.
Amazing. Well, it does tie into partying, so I thought it was a nice segue. But yeah, I was just kind of wanting to highlight the fact you seem to have had this interest in not necessarily making money, but you alluded to it there, actually just doing things that you enjoyed. And, you know, the fact you got paid £90 from people for doing a New Year's party is pretty cool. And you say 13, 14 years old. And I believe then you've then taken that a little bit further. So we're kind of going to some sort of chronology to bring it to present day. But I wanted to kind of pick out the things that I thought were really interesting. And you mentioned, I think, somewhere about doing club nights. And you then went on to do one of the biggest club nights in the east of England. Is that right? And would you want to maybe fill in some of the gaps there a little bit?
Did indeed, absolutely. That was, it basically came out of the back of going to college and wanting to make friends. And of course, as you know, had the DJ experience. From there, it was, how do we make friends in college? The best way we could do that is throwing a party. The best way that we could ensure that the parties would continue is to make sure that we weren't the ones funding them all of the time. Therefore, we needed to sell tickets. And my friend at the time, you know, we went to school together. We decided that we would hire out a nightclub. We would sell tickets, put on some acts, and get to a place where we were filling it out with, you know, hundreds and then thousands of people that across the year would come and party with us. We extended the venues, we moved venues. It was just this tiny thing. We had 122 people come to the first event, which we had sold tickets on the street for about maybe, I don't know, 3 months prior. So every Saturday, Sunday, we would be out in the city centre in Norwich, where we were from. And we would be standing there, handing out flyers, trying to sell tickets, £6, £8, £10. It's crazy when you think about it, but we would have a bag filled with like fivers and, you know, £10 notes and change and cash. It wasn't digital currency. It wasn't any of that. And if you wanted to purchase a ticket online, you'd purchase via PayPal. Mm. You know, it's just... it's mad. Like, there wasn't Eventbrite to take tickets and, you know, that type of stuff. So yeah, we would do that, and it turned into something which was an awful lot of fun. It was an awful lot of fun. We enjoyed every moment of it, from the foam parties to the popcorn cannons to the guest DJ sets to, yeah, just, it was just fun. That's what it was. Yeah.
Yeah. I want to dig into this a little bit more. In terms of the specifics of actually selling the tickets, so this, I feel so bad for actually asking this question because it's not going to mean anything to listeners, but was this on Prince of Wales Road by any chance? Like, I'm just picturing it in my head, like, where you were selling these tickets in Norwich.
No, do you know what? We didn't sell tickets on Prince of Wales. We actually sold tickets at the base of the hill of Chapel Field. As you walk up past M&S and Topshop,
yeah,
that was pretty much the one channel into the major shopping center. So we would sit there 4 or 5 hours a time on a Saturday daytime.
Wow.
And we would just sell and sell and sell and sell.
And what was your pitch to people to actually sell these tickets? Were you like promising an amazing fun night and they're going to meet, you know, DJs and all this sort of thing? Or was it a bit more, yeah, like what was your pitch essentially to these people, to these random people?
It was definitely like that. You know, it was about the night itself. But what had happened at the same time, that there was a government cut on social, youth social centres or youth clubs. And there were a couple of providers of these youth club nights that were happening. So what's worth noting is that these club nights predominantly were under 18 nights. So they were from 16 to 18. They were alcohol-free, drug-free, tobacco-free events. They were safe environments. We had a partnership with the police, and you know, it was a safe thing that, if you were young and you wanted to go and have a party, then, you know, you would go and do. So we were 17 at the time and kind of, you know, that's what we just thought would, you know, be a cool idea for our peers. As a result of the social clubs or the youth clubs shutting down, there was this kind of surplus of, you know, I guess, what do we do? Like, what should we do? So my friend and I, we kind of played on that as well, that we could solve this problem. And we did, you know, genuinely we did. We loved what we did. We got really into the politics of kind of giving young people another opportunity. And we got really excited by the party itself and how incredible we could make an alternative youth center as such. And we married the both together and created something which did excite people in you know, in the region, to the point where we had three locations. We were then being asked if we wanted to license the brand as far as Leicester from Norwich, you know, still, we didn't know what we were doing. We were just enjoying the moment. And that's kind of where it stemmed from.
Was it just yourself and your friend who were doing all of this at this point? Or did you bring people on board to help actually run these parties? Yeah, what did that look like?
Started as me and him. We were the two people that were out every weekend, after school, after college, all of that kind of stuff, walking up and down those sorts of places. And then I think it must have been after the first, event. Yeah, I think it probably was. After the first event, we realized that there was an opportunity. And we had one guy who came up to us afterwards, actually, everybody was leaving. And he said, you know, best thing he's ever been to, loved it. Can he tell his friends at school and all that kind of stuff, or at college, wherever he was? And I remember we said, well, if you sell some tickets, we can give you, you know, we'll give you a pound every ticket type thing.
Cool.
And I think that was probably the first time we recruited inadvertently, certainly not as professionally as maybe we would nowadays, but that was the first time we did. And then, yeah, it stemmed from there. I think by the time we finished, we had, we probably had 8 reps that would go out into different colleges and schools and sixth forms and all that kind of stuff and sell these tickets. So we were still turning up and doing it at the weekend, but we had people that were doing it as well alongside us, and amplifying our kind of existence in different areas of the county too.
So cool. And we will move on to something else very shortly, but I find this fascinating, particularly with the interest in, I'm just picturing the location that you're selling these tickets and, you know, you're growing this thing with young people. And in terms of actually getting these locations on board, because I'm guessing you've got these people who are, you know, these building owners, or I don't quite know how it works, but say there's people owning these buildings and then they're letting out some space to some young people to have a party. Did they have any objections or what was their, I guess, things they were throwing in your way to say, no, actually, we don't want this to happen? Did you face any of that sort of backlash a little bit?
Absolutely. Finding the first venue was super difficult. I remember emailing probably most of the venues that we felt that had the capacity in Norwich, and either they not getting back to us or they weren't interested. There were a few conversations that happened, and when it came down to should we take it forward, it never did. The conversation that I had with Media Night Club is one I still honour and sort of respect the opportunity that they gave us even to this day. I remember I went into to meet the general manager, still a friend even today. And I told him the idea. I said, this is what I want to try and achieve. This is what our aim is. And, you know, I remember turning up in a suit with a tie.
Nice.
And thinking, right, I need to be a businessman type of thing with a little briefcase. And you know, I had no idea what I was doing, but that was what it was. The building owner, I then met the building owner, and we talked about it. They said, this is the higher cost. And if you can fill it with some people and you can prove what you want to do, then, you know, we'll look at doing something again and sort of speak about it. The first event, we paid the higher fee full out. The second event, we split the higher fee with the venue and split costs because they could see that we had a bit of an idea and a vision that we wanted to move towards. So I think the message out of that really is, well, if you're a kind of somebody listening, thinking, how do I get started? There's often challenges, there's often barriers, there's often people that are going to close the door, but there is also, by that same merit, somebody that will get where you're trying to, you know, what you're trying to achieve and where you're trying to go.
Mm, definitely. Yeah, it's a common theme I've had with conversations, particularly my cousin, who travels around the world now shooting videos of his best mate, and they do some really cool things for big companies. But he was saying that he regularly sends excess of like 50 emails a day outreaching to people like, do you want to, you know, work with us? And he'd kind of show them the work he'd done and things. And he'd say, like, yeah, 3/4 of the time no one got back to him, and occasionally someone will nibble and then not respond or ghost him, so to speak, but there will be one or two people out of those 50 who will, yeah, give him a chance. And that's kind of how he's got going, and I've, yeah, countless other examples of that, which I think is fascinating.
Got to ask. People underestimate the power of asking.
Yeah. Why do you think that is? Do you think it's fear, or do you think they'll get rejected? Yeah, why do you think that is?
Great question. My view probably is fear. I think there's the misconceptions that surround asking as well. There's the fear of failed response, no response. There's the fear of it maybe being a different response than the one that you desire. And I think potentially as well, persistence falls into that, i.e. I've asked so many times before, this answer is going to be the same. Mm. So why ask? What do you think? What's your thoughts on it?
Yeah, I think you're probably right. I think it's that lack of trust in what you're doing is the right thing. So if you're constantly facing no, then chances are there's going to come a point where you're thinking, is this the right approach? And you might try something different just before you'll actually get success in that approach. I think, yeah, fear as well. You know, we as humans don't like hearing no, I think. So I think that probably plays a part as well. Something I was going to come back to was when you are approaching these managers, did you already have tickets sold at that point, or had you just told them your vision and you were then going to sell the tickets? Yeah, was it? What was that like?
Yeah, not at all. Not at all. It's just an idea.
Just an idea. Yeah, okay.
Yeah, it was just, can we do it? That was it.
That's interesting, because I wasn't sure if you'd pre-sold these tickets, and then, because presumably that would give you a bit more leverage to say, okay, we've already sold these tickets for this event, we just need somewhere to host it. But now you've gone in and actually pitch the idea first before selling the tickets. Interesting.
Yeah, I was 17 years old and just thought, I really want to throw a cool party. There's an opportunity. I've got enough to cover the deposit. Can we do it? That was pretty much it.
Well, that's even more ballsy than I was thinking, because, yeah, I guess if you'd sold some tickets, at least then you've got something to say, okay, I've got some proof of concept. But the fact you've approached it from that angle, yeah, fair play, you've managed to pull it off. So it's very, very cool. I did say we'd move on to something else, because there is so much I want to talk to you about. And this is a very random segue, but we'll go with it. So you've gone from nightclubs to wind turbines. Please explain, because this, again, just seems fascinating. And tying in with the wind turbines, armored glass as well, which I saw. Yeah, selling these things. Yeah, how on earth did that happen?
Really random experiences. So I went through a period of time where my friend and I, who we were running, whilst we were running the nightclub events, so it wasn't actually a transition from the nightclub events to the wind turbines, armored glass, and a whole plethora of other things. We had a website which would sell photography as well. We had a photography website. We had we would build small micro business websites as well for £99. We were doing app development. Essentially, the period of time whilst we were running these events, where we were, you know, arguably making some money with them, we were just doing any fun thing that we could imagine. And it was, you know, as an example, a taxi company contacted us because we were holding these events. They wanted to get involved in them. And then they said, you know, wouldn't it be cool if there was a taxi app? And this is before Uber, of course. So we built an app which essentially allowed you to book your taxi. And we had not much experience in app development, but we found people that did, and we would just do it. We had this tiny little office where there was the two of us that would sit in there. We would listen to hours and hours and hours of sort of trap music on YouTube and sort of house music. And, you know, we'd work from 7 in the morning all the way through till sometimes 11, 12 at night. It would be later. We'd do 48-hour days sometimes. And we would just get involved in things that sounded interesting. The wind turbines, essentially, through a friend of my business partner at the time, he found a guy that needed to sell some wind turbine blades. And we built a website, and we had all of the interaction with them via online and email and telephone. So they didn't know that we were essentially baby-faced, sort of, you know, entrepreneurial. Yeah, and then, you know, we would just marketed it, and we were just trying. I mean, we got close to securing deals, but we didn't cross anything over the line. But again, it wasn't about that. Same with the photography business. It was about us thinking we could solve a problem that existed in a way that hadn't been done, and we weren't afraid to try it. I can look back and think of times now where we would, as I say, come up with an idea on a Tuesday. We would be testing, developing, creating that idea all through Tuesday evening, Wednesday morning, like early hours. We would have ordered some sort of takeaway, or we would stop at the, you know, they walk down to the local shop to get microwave meals, and we would by Friday have the product live in a sort of an MVP form, and we'd just try it. And if it didn't work by Tuesday next week, it would be turned off and we'd be on something else. Sometimes it did work. We made cash and we kept it going. Sometimes it didn't, and we decided we'll progress. Some failed, some worked. That was happening whilst we were still earning the cash from the live event business. But at the same time, it wasn't something that we took any less seriously. We were constantly looking for the next thing. We were constantly innovating. We were constantly questioning, you know, what was going on. How could we help? Could we develop something? And it just grew and grew and grew to the point where we tried to hire out a whole beach at one stage. And I remember, this is a really random story, but it kind of goes to show how we were thinking. So we wanted to hire a beach in Norfolk to hold a festival, which we were calling the On the Sands Festival. And the thought was that we would just bring down about 35,000-40,000 people to, you know, attend this festival on the beach. And we would have... I wrote a letter to Jay-Z and Robbie Williams.
Whoa.
Randomly. You know, it's just strange the things you do when you're young as well. But I wrote a letter to them asking if they would come and perform. And I said, you know, we're two young entrepreneurs. We haven't got much money. Could we, you know, if we paid you £1 million each, would that be okay? because, you know, we worked out the sums and we thought if we sold X tickets, then it would all work out. So... and we need to pay you afterwards and all of this stuff, which is ridiculous now when you think about it, but it was just where we were at. And we went to the meeting with the council, and turned up, they were kind of ready for a discussion about a festival on a beach. And there was, you know, seven or eight sort of the council people in there that were, you know, head of operations, head of traffic, head of this, head of that. It was me turn up with a folder, and they said, you know, what is it you want to know? And I remember this as clear as day. I said, well, so I'll just look through my notes. And I printed off this document of like how to run a festival with like checklists. And the first thing on there was, do you have toilets? So, and I just said, do you have toilets? And they were like, what? And at that point I knew, wow, I'm so... like I'm out of my depth.
That's amazing. I love that story.
True story.
It reminds me of, I was watching a Netflix documentary fairly recently about the Fyre Festival. I don't know if you've come across that.
Yeah, it was similar.
That's fantastic. No, that's, I mean, that shows a real ambition. And how did the council react? Like, did they tell you, you know, politely, what you're doing, like this is a terrible idea, or did they go along with it? Yeah, what was their approach?
They entertained us for, I think it was in total, 3 meetings.
Oh wow, okay. Yep. That's quite a lot.
So first meeting I said, you know, we're going to come back with a bit of a plan, bit of a proposal. I had the branding and the visualization, we'd prepared that so you could sort of get the vision of where we were going. We had a second meeting which we then went around to view the space, so we essentially walked the beach, walked the properties, walked, you know, the whole thing. third meeting was with the production company, which we invited down. And they were a big production company that could, you know, facilitate a festival. They came to see everything. You know, they actually schooled us a little bit. You know, they were asking questions about power supplies. I know that sounds really simple, you know, but we were, you know, I think we were 19 at the time and had really no idea. And they were talking about different power supplies and boarding here and tracks on the beach and how we're going to get, you know, craning vehicles down and off and protecting people from the sea if it comes in. And, you know, all of these things, like, I appreciate they sound really simple, like now. And as an adult, I can look back and think, yeah, makes sense. But we had these meetings. They asked how we were going to pay for it all. And we had no idea how we were going to pay for it all, but we just assumed that we possibly could pay for it all somehow. We thought it was going to work out in the end, and surely it will be okay. So we said, "Oh, well, we've got some savings. We've also got some backers, and we are going to, you know, we're going to raise some finance for it." Turns out we couldn't raise any finance for it. So the On the Sands Festival stopped there and then.
And was that the only thing that stopped it in the end? Like, did everyone come on board with the idea, or were they still very skeptical and actually they didn't think you were going to pull through?
I think they were skeptical. I think they were very skeptical. Like, even if we did turn up with a £10 million check one day and said, look, you know, actually we're ready to go, I think they still would have been a little bit nervous by our level of incompetence. Or certainly inexperience.
Yeah, well, fair enough. I mean, like, say you're 19, and actually you said something quite interesting. You know, they sound like simple questions. But actually, again, going back to that fire festival, the thing that surprised me so much was these were experienced businessmen. I don't know if you know the story about Fire Festival, by the way, yeah. But the thing that struck
me... Great documentary.
Great documentary, right? And I kind of heard about this fire festival. I just didn't know the extremes and how badly it had gone, but... The thing that struck me was, you know, these were experienced businessmen who had run businesses before and they'd raised a lot of money before. And obviously they'd raised a lot of money to run this festival, and it all just went completely tits up because they didn't consider things like toilets, which was one of your first questions. And, you know, how were they going to feed people? How were they going to shuttle them to this island, which wasn't an island? Like, so many things that happened.
There you go. Maybe if they sorted me out as a consultant for and I brought my checklist, they wouldn't have had many problems.
Exactly. I'm guessing this checklist, did that just come out of a Google search? You just like printed something off very quickly.
Don't give away the secrets. Don't give away the secrets. Exactly that.
It's lovely. I mean, I could ask you so many more questions about that, and I dare say I will at some other point. But to take it on to what you are currently doing now with Duco. Yeah, it sounds fascinating. And actually, again, I've obviously dug into it a little bit more, but I'd be curious to hear, I guess, the background as I believe it. So yourself and a friend who are, you know, enjoy climbing, and you came up with this idea to create this brand, if you like, that turned, yeah, waste into clothes. How did that idea actually come to fruition? Like, did you recognize that, you know, was it like the ocean waste that was the issue first and then you wanted to try and solve that problem? Or was it more you wanted to have a product that was suitable for climbing? Yeah, what was the chicken and egg, if you like?
It's a great question. So my best friend and I, we were rock climbing. We enjoyed the physicality and the mental strategy of climbing. We enjoyed it. We didn't enjoy the clothes that people were wearing. Very subjective view there, but we were turning up to the climbing walls, which, you know, were growing in terms of their size and the locations that they were popping up in. We were turning up in Nike, Adidas, your kind of, I guess, more mainstream gym attire, and others in the climbing centers were in more traditional climbing clothes, and they would be things that aesthetically didn't suit our vision for who we were. Mm-hmm. I have nothing against people that wear mustard trousers and bright pink t-shirts or anything like that. Like, that's your style. You go with that, but it wasn't ours. And we just decided we wanted to wear something different. And we were going through a bit of a stage I guess in our friendship too, like sort of you do with your best friend, where you question like, are we having enough adventures together? Are we doing enough cool stuff together? This year we're going to do this. This year we're going to do that. And we were having those chats. So we decided we'd come up with our own club, our own thing, and we would get a t-shirt made. So we needed a name. We went through loads of names. We had everything from names we didn't really know how to pronounce, but sounded quite cool on paper or looked cool. In the end, we came up with Duco. Duco, as we said at the start, meaning I lead in Latin. And it was just for us. So I kind of just drew the logo out. It was my handwriting. Says Duco. We got it vectorized, printed on 2 12-pound t-shirts, and we would wear them. And that was it. That was Duco. The whole thing was just that. We enjoyed the mini club that we had. You put your Duco t-shirt on a Thursday when we'd go to climb, Thursday evening, and it was our thing. You know, we were ready to go and travel the world, to go on a spaceship. We were... You know, you were in another world, like it was our thing. But it was through that journey then, when people were asking us if they could get their own Duco, can I get a t-shirt? Where do you get that t-shirt from? That we then started to look into how we actually manufacture our own. And that's when we learned about the damage to the world that the fashion industry does. And that's when we made the decision that we were going to change it if we were going to take this seriously.
And we will circle back to that angle. I'm curious, why do you think people liked the t-shirt so much? Because by the sounds of it, you're saying it was a £12 t-shirt with a logo on it. Like, by all appearances, maybe it's not that attractive. I don't know. Like, was it like a really good design, do you think? Like, what do you think attracted people to it?
I don't know if it was a really good design. It was just the word Duco on the front. It was a navy, I've still got the original actually. It's a navy blue tee with a pink Duco sort of written across the front chest. Center aligned. I don't know what it was. Maybe it was just maybe it was us wearing it in the, you know, we genuinely, I can't, I don't say that with arrogance. They may have came across in an arrogant way, but what I mean by it was when we put the t-shirts on and when we were wearing Duco, we were wearing what Duco stood for. And that was comradeship. It was bettering one another. It was supporting each other. It was growth. It was adventure. It was this mission that we still have today, which is to climb higher, which for us is the bettering one another and each other. And by that, I don't just mean us singly. I mean the everybody that we came in contact with. So I think that was our Superman suit, if you will. We would put that on and we would be in the zone. And maybe that was what drew people to it rather than the design itself. Mm. But then again, I don't know. I really don't know.
It's interesting. Yeah, maybe it's the energy you brought, the fact you are wearing these t-shirts. And like you say, it's almost like your Superman cape and you are presumably having fun on these climbing walls and you're just wearing these t-shirts you've created. This is cool. It's really cool. And so you said then that you went about finding a manufacturer for these t-shirts. What did that process look like? Can you remember, like, did you have any idea of where to find manufacturers? Was this more like Google searching? Yeah. How did that look for you?
It was all Google. Early days when we were looking for just t-shirts, it was a Google search, find somebody that could print on sustainable organic material, and find somebody that could deliver on a minimum order quantity that was sustainable for us. Values that we could afford, as well as quantities that weren't going to outprice us sort of in terms of to sell them on and make sure we had a bit of a margin. Although I must admit, we spent so much money on just buying things that said Duco on it. You know, I'm sure other people with brands, certainly that kind of start things up, it's just so exhilarating to just see your brand on something. So we would just buy stuff that was just, again, just the criteria was always it needs to be environmentally friendly, ethically made, ethically sourced. It couldn't just be, you know, tat. It needed to be good stuff. Mm-hmm. But if we could get our logo on it, then we would likely purchase it just for us to sort of see.
Yeah. And was this just clothing at this point, or did you? Because I'm just picturing my head went straight to like Vistaprint, where you're getting like business cards and pens and stuff with your logo on. Yeah, was it just clothing, or did you get other products as well?
It wasn't as extreme as that, and we weren't delving into all of those more merchandise-esque type of things. We had things from bandanas to beanies to vests, jumpers, hoodies, shorts, socks, flags. I remember purchasing a bunch of flags because I just felt like if we were going to have a brand, we needed a brand on a flag, you know?
Yeah.
there's no logic to it. It's just that. but again, like it was Google searching companies that could do this in the quantities that we wanted, the delivery time that we wanted, and purchasing them. It was only then when we decided we wanted to take the next step to manufacture our own things. That's when it changed a little bit more.
Okay, so let's talk about that a little bit. How did you go from outsourcing it to someone else to then bringing it in-house and doing it yourself? Like, did you have to get premises? Did you have to employ people to actually make these clothes? Yeah, what did that all look like?
It was a difficult process. It was one that taught us an awful lot every time we failed, and we failed often. We would hit every barrier that you could. We didn't have any experience in making garments. We had no experience in fashion, per se. We had no experience in sportswear manufacture. We found people that did. We went to organizations that could create garments. We went to designers, fashion designers. We went to people that could provide the specification, tech packs, the more detailed thing for actual design garment manufacturing. We found some incredible contacts that could see what we were trying to do and believe in our vision of what we wanted to try and achieve. Because at a time when we came to, when we had the ambition to manufacture our own product and move away from just creating, another t-shirt brand for a small group of people type thing, we had the ambition to create garments that were sustainably manufactured using environmentally friendly materials in an ethical setting. We wanted to never compromise on performance, and therefore we wanted to make the most incredible sportswear garments, which were essentially made from rubbish. You know, we wanted to create the best garments that we could out of waste. And therefore, we did start to attract some really interesting people that had never thought that it either could be done or had never really considered it. Or so designers from, ex-designers from Adidas, from Nike, very senior people as well that saw where we were going. And at that stage, we believed in what we were doing a bit more. And as you open your door, your network, you grow your network, they know people in their industries too, or subsequently friends and colleagues or peers. So we had, I don't know how many conversations, hundreds of conversations with different factories, hundreds, until we then eventually found one, not to go into too much sort of boring detail maybe, but, I would go to trade shows and trade fairs to meet with fabric warehouses, to manufacturers, and, some of them were way too big for us, and we only knew that after we had been through the experience. We found somebody in Norwich that could help us design our kits and manufacture out in Bulgaria, which we did, and that was our first product that we manufactured. Then we had this idea of these incredible sportswear garments that we went from Turkey to Bulgaria to Lisbon to where else did we go? Well, I think we ended up to Vietnam, into China. We were globetrotting to find these, not physically, but we were globetrotting to find the right people.
Mm-hmm. And I'm just thinking, like, logistically, did you have to provide the materials to these companies? Like, did you have to, or these factories even? Like, did you have to, I'm just thinking, like, did you physically have to collect this, like, ocean waste, or are there other companies that supply this material which you can then send on to these factories? Yeah, how does that kind of work, I guess?
Yeah, it's a really great question. And to be really honest with you, I had no idea about this process before actually going through it. So when you see some sort of t-shirt brands on Instagram and they're selling a load of printed goods, normally the process is I would design something, I send it to a t-shirt printer or an embroider or whatever it is, and they would purchase pre-made t-shirts. The logo goes on, or the design goes on. It then goes to a fulfillment warehouse, or it gets sent to me. I box it and fulfill it. That's pretty mm-hmm. simple. The process there is selecting out of a catalog from a select set of colors, from a select sort of region of areas that you could print on or you could embroider. You have some pretty straightforward boundaries. When it comes to actually manufacturing your own product, some of those things do exist by the very nature of design and kind of manufacturing technique, but you are on an open playing field. So I didn't realize that, first of all, once you go past all of the sort of mood boarding and you're sort of clear with the more illustrative, creative concepts, that then you need to create tech packs. And tech packs are essentially how the garment's going to lay out, the elements of, so if you make a t-shirt now, it's the sleeve is one piece of fabric, the body is the front is a piece of fabric, the back is a piece of fabric. You lay all of those out. You then have the sizings to them, and it's done in millimeters and, kind of inches, and, it's precision.
Oh, okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that sort of stuff. And then if you want to have a logo on the left shoulder, or you want to have, a tag on the right, or you want the wash instructions in the collar, or you want the wash instructions up the back, or you want them printed or labeled, or the list goes on and on and on. And I had no idea. And it was only through going through then speaking to different people that, we kind of got through that stage. But back to your question, once you've got your tech pack, you would then make this the templates so the fabric can be cut. So you then have to template in paper all of the sizing of the materials and all that kind of stuff. And then at that stage, it goes to be cut and be sampled. So you would then either make your own sample, which we had tried to do to send to a factory, or you would have them make a sample. And often the samples aren't made in the end fabric, so they're made in an alternative fabric, just so you can kind of get sizing and fit and all that kind of stuff. And then you go through the process of sourcing your materials. So materials can be provided by the factory if they've got good relationships with local suppliers or national suppliers, or you can source your own and get it sent in. We decided at the very end, we would go through the factory and we would go through the supply chain that worked for them rather than trying to build something else. And often factories have relationships with people that they don't want to, they don't want to go to somebody else. So mm-hmm. we then went through the process of selecting factories and suppliers. And as part of that, we found and we sourced recyclable and certified recycled suppliers. So we didn't trawl the ocean physically. I wasn't out there in a boat trawling the ocean for fishing net and all of that kind of stuff. We invested in companies that did that process and then turned that product, that end waste, into a material, and then we would buy that material at that stage to then go to our factory to be made into a garment. Once they've sampled it,
wow.
Once they've created the temp, or they've actually, now we've got a physical thing, you make the changes, you tweak it, you get it tucked in, you look at all of the embellishments. So if you're having heat raised logos, you're having embroidery, you're having, there's so many things you can do. Like, and I'm not going to do this process any justice. And to any experienced fashionista, designer, creator out there, probably think I don't know what I'm talking about at all, because, I'm still very much learning. But, you go through all of those things, and then at that stage, you kind of hit go on 500 garments, 600 garments, 1,000 garments, and you are in, you're just in that process then. There's no going back. That's what it is.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for explaining all that. That is fascinating. I didn't realize how many steps went into making a custom t-shirt like that. I mean, crazy. And it kind of sounds like with the tech packs, it just reminds me almost like an architect's drawing. Like they'll do really detailed sketches to construct a house. And it sounds like that same sort of process actually with down to the millimeter.
I was going to say, I appreciate this is an audio thing, but if this was an audio, then I'd show you, I could show you the designs on screen. I could show you how it worked. Because the garments we've got retailing on our website at the moment, they took 18 months to come to fruition. Like it wasn't just like, okay, let's come up with this. We'll do this tomorrow. It was 18 months of testing, because of course, once you've got samples, you test them. We can't just go with the material. We have to test the material. We have to wash the material. You have to see where the durability of it is. We wanted to create sustainable garments, not just that used environmental materials, but had a long lease of life. They weren't things that you would replace in 3 months' time, a year's time. This is something that's going to have a lifetime with you. So, you know, it needed some testing too. So you've got that to factor in as well.
Yeah, makes sense. I hadn't even thought of that, but it makes, yeah. I think I'm thinking of companies like Patagonia who, if a product comes back defective, they'll just replace it and return it to the user, like a brand new one, because they trust their product so much. And that's amazing. It's kind of opened my eyes a lot, actually. And I'm very conscious of time because I would love to ask a billion more questions.
Oh, well, yeah.
I've got plenty of time. I'm just conscious that I don't want to take too much more of your time. In terms of the impact of, I don't want to really mention it, but the COVID thing that happens to be a thing. Yeah, has that impacted the business in any way, shape or form? You know, are people buying less clothes from you? You don't have to go into specifics of that, but are they buying more? Yeah, what's the kind of trend been for you so far?
Absolutely. COVID and Brexit affected us. In both senses, you know, we went through, let me step back. Brexit affected us because the suppliers we were originally working with decided that they wanted to charge us some more. We couldn't afford to go through with it. The supply chain changed, the relationships changed, and therefore we needed to go back to the drawing board. So we lost about 6 to 8 months in that process. We then went through a new process. We manufactured, rebuilt, we did what we did, and we come into 2020 eventually, and then COVID comes around. COVID affected us because originally we had product out in coming through from Vietnam, China, and we had product coming through those two locations. They were hit first of all by COVID, of course, so there was a bit of a lockdown over there that stalled some of our product. Our kind of a retail product. Then it came into a distribution center in Central Europe. And of course, at this time, Central Europe was then shutting down next. Mm. And then it was going to come over to us. And then we shut down and the borders shut down. And then it was a case of at the borders, we were getting in PPE and products that were, to service the need of the country to defeat or protect from COVID. So we had some logistical challenges in that respect to start with. We also stock retailers, and of course retailers shut down. One of our retailers, a national retailer, at the start of lockdown went into liquidation. Mm-hmm. And they kind of shut down sort of from day one, and we just supplied a huge order for us into them. We sort of, as I think I mentioned, or you did, we supplied the GB climbing team's kit for 2019 ahead of the sort of Tokyo Olympics, and that was an incredible achievement for us, and we were looking forward to using the momentum of the investment we made into that kit, the investment we made into those athletes, the investment that we could see would come out of the Tokyo Olympics. We can't ride that wave whilst the world is shut down, and we can't ride that wave whilst Tokyo doesn't exist. And then you get to a place where, because of the new changes with Brexit again, and I appreciate I'm going back between Brexit and COVID and all this kind of stuff, but then we're in a position where it's difficult now to get product into this country. It's difficult to get product out of this country. I'm not saying it's impossible, but it's certainly not as easy as it was. So where we would be shipping product to America or Canada, Europe, it's not as easy anymore, the same way as it's not as easy to get our product in through the borders either. So overall, it's been a very challenging year, but it's been one that's taught us a lot, an awful lot.
Lots to take on board. What has been the biggest lesson do you think you've learned from the past year?
It's a really good question. And I think possibly the biggest lesson has been that it's okay to breathe. I guess what I mean by that is the world went into, you know, chaos, lockdown, pandemic, complete shutdown. And we had an awful lot of people that faced adversity, challenge, and of course we can't ignore the health, negative health challenges here too, and death ultimately. And throughout that, we've been able to navigate through as a business, but also navigate through as entrepreneurs, because from month one, whatever it was, I remember writing an email to our investors and I just said, I'm not sure where this is going to go. I'm not sure what's going to happen here, but I'm going to try my best and we'll see what happens. They all came back and said, just do what you can. Do what you can to steer this through. And you know what? I took a breath at that point and I realized the pressure that I was applying to myself immediately through this, and I had been in the past, maybe wasn't as necessary. I'm not saying it isn't needed at times. I'm not saying that there shouldn't be a sense of urgency and a sense of drive, but taking a breath is also, I think, as important. And I think hopefully the world has learned that this year as well.
Practically, what did that look like for you? Was it literally a matter of not putting as many hours into the business, or were you giving yourself more time to look after yourself, like go for walks and see family and friends? Yeah, what did that look like for you?
It was a bit of both. It was a combination of not working every hour under the sun. It was a combination of deciding that it wasn't an issue if I didn't want to work on a sun off this Friday. I thought, do you know what? I'm going to chill. I'm not going to put anything into this. Whereas before, as you can probably tell, it would have been 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. And maybe it's because I'm getting older now. I don't know, but yeah.
Yeah, it's fascinating. Thank you for sharing all of that. I think, yeah, just to add on to that point about what COVID has taught us, I can relate, not the business side of things, but it's only taking a breath. That's a really nice way of putting it. And actually just realizing what I think, for one, you need, but also what you don't need. I've realized what I don't need a lot more, which has been an interesting discovery. So yeah, it's a kind of a weird note to end it on, because I appreciate it sounds like you've had a lot of challenges, and I was going to ask about future plans, but I think somehow I don't even know what's happening next week, let alone next year. So it must be really difficult to plan that far ahead in business as well. I'll let you think on that if you do want to answer that question. But a question I would like to wrap things up with is a bit more lighthearted, you might say. So let's picture the scene. We're driving down the American highway and we see a billboard to the side, which could be seen by potentially thousands of people every single year. What do you think you'd write on this billboard? And again, I'll give you a bit of time, so it doesn't have to be deep. It could be a quip, piece of advice, story, whatever you want it to be. But if you could write something on the billboard for thousands of people to see, what would it be and why?
Really, really good question. Love it. I'll jump back to your first question to answer that. We do have plans for the future, absolutely. We are progressing with new product development. And what we have found through COVID, which has been great, is we found people have come to us to help them develop product. So we now are in a position where we can make product for other people. And whilst it may not be going out the door as a Duco product, we are helping people to do exactly what our mission is around that climb higher. We're helping people achieve what they want to do in creating sustainable products, environmentally friendly products with a supply chain that they can trust, certified materials. and offset by reforestation, so carbon offset by reforestation, which, you know, we're bringing out vegan trainers. So we've got mushroom leather trainers, biodegradable sunglasses, recycled sunglasses, seaweed yoga mats. We've got so much cool stuff going on. So in that respect, we're just doubling down into that investment of, you know, what can we do that isn't just about us? And as a result, yeah, we're making some cool things. We're making some cool products. So definitely the future is still bright, whilst it maybe isn't as event filled or high street retail filled. And, you know, sales aren't as fast as I'd like them to be. Definitely. We're still very optimistic. Absolutely.
Awesome. That's a really nice answer. Before you come to the billboard, I just wanted to interject very quickly. A company, I believe, is based in Norfolk. You may have even heard of them. A company called Coral Sunglasses that just sprung to mind. I know they do a lot of recycling of, I don't know if it's ocean waste, but I think they do biodegradable. You're nodding your heads. Yeah, is it a company you're aware of?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, another great company. You know, I think what we can see around the country is, and it's great that it's coming from Norwich as well. You know, we've got people that can visualize things that maybe have never been visualized in recycled or sustainable materials, and then are willing to go and try and create them. So sunglasses is a great example of somebody taking that opportunity and doing something cool with it. And Coral Eyewear is a great opportunity for that, a great brand for that. But there are so many others that are out there with an idea of how do we take this thing that we always use and make it far less wasteful, or we offset carbon, or we, you know, create it less, you know, damaging to the planet. And I just think it's not only the right thing to do, it's something we have a responsibility to do. One day we're gonna pass this down to a generation, and there's almost an arrogance even saying that, like we own it, but because we don't. But, you know, we at least are guardians, and I don't want to leave this place worse than we had it. And already there's some pretty dark forces in the world that are trying to do that. So we need to be as much of the light as we can. Yeah, I don't know. I was going off on one there.
Yeah. No. I like that phrase. We're guardians of the earth. We're not, like I said, there's an arrogance around saying we're passing it down in some ways, or we're kind of in control of it, because clearly we're just a small part of it. Something that sprung to mind as well, this is complete random thought again. I have a lot of these during these conversations, but I thought it might be of interest to you, because I was on Kickstarter. I like to go on that website occasionally just to browse through the products and things. And there was one that really caught my eye, and it was actually, you may have even seen it. I believe it's a company that is doing like roll-on deodorant, but recyclable. So essentially you get refilled roll-ons, because there was a lot of waste around that, you know, plastic just being chucked away for no reason. So I thought it was really cool. I think they're making it out of like bamboo canes or something like that. I thought it was really cool. Yeah, I just wanted to bring that to your attention, because you might find it interesting.
What was the name?
I can't remember off the top of my head, which is really annoying. I will find it and send you a link afterwards, and I'll put a link to it in the show notes as well. Yeah, I was really tempted to invest, but then I thought, I don't really use roll-on deodorant. I just tend to use the spray. But I thought, for travel-wise, like, you know, if you're going traveling abroad or something like that, that could be a really cool product. So yeah, I'll definitely send you a link to it afterwards. Have you thought about your billboard message, what you'd like to write on it?
Well, this is a very tricky one, because, you know, I'm kind of maybe overanalyzing it now. You've given me the time to to think about it, but I'll go in the vein of it being around entrepreneurship and for entrepreneurs. So I'm assuming that everybody that goes past this is an entrepreneur. A piece of advice I was given years and years ago, well, there's plenty of pieces of advice that, you know, some you take with a pinch of salt and some you sort of latch onto. But there was one piece that I quite enjoy and I reflect on often, which is, don't let your success go to your head or your failures go to your heart. And I just often reflect on that and think, do you know what, that's actually a really, yeah, just remember that, you know, this isn't, yeah, I don't know. That's probably what I'd write on there if they were all entrepreneurs kind of driving past.
Yeah, that's really powerful. It reminds me of something I like to remind myself of, and it was I read on Medium quite a lot, and something I saw, probably not quote to this guy, but he said that you're never as good as your biggest fan, you're never as bad as your worst critic, or something along those lines. And I thought it was quite a nice message.
Now, what would you write on the billboard?
What would I write? It's something a few guests have asked me, and I thought I actually had to come up with an answer, because when someone asked me for the first time, I didn't. So yeah, it's something I thought about. I really like Oscar Wilde as a writer, and I don't know if it's actually credited to him, but he said something along the lines of, be yourself, you know, everyone else is already taken. I think that's how it ties in. I'd reword it so it actually sounds coherent, but I'd put it on that. So Kieran, yeah, it's been a real pleasure. Thank you so much for your time. So people can find you on Instagram at Kieran_Miles_, at official Duco as a Duco as well. So at official Duco on Instagram, DucoLife.com as well. And you also got your own personal website, which I was really impressed by because it's so simplistic. I love that approach, almost like a CV of sorts, KieranMiles.com. Yeah, anywhere else you'd like to direct listeners towards? Any final thoughts before we jump off?
When you say it like that, it sounds so cringy, that does. It was exactly that. It was a kind of like an online CV. It was, you know, having a place to put it all together. But no, yeah, when you say it like that, it sounds incredibly cringy. And
I mean it in a compliment form, not in a cringe form. I've seen similar websites on other people following LinkedIn, and I always think it's really effective because, you know, I'm actually, it's a complete tangent, I've recently redone my website, and it's just a simple landing page now from ConvertKit, because I realized I had all these pages that no one ever saw, never clicked on, all these posts that people never read. So I was like, why have I got all this stuff? Might as well just have it really simplistic. Personally prefer that, you know, you can read it in like 10 seconds and get to where you want to go to. So I think it's a nice approach. Anyway, were there any final thoughts you wanted to add? Or
all I will say is, Scott, thank you so much for having me on. I genuinely really enjoy chatting to you today. It's been really, really interesting. You've made me think of things that I haven't reflected upon for many years, and you've questioned in a very thought-provoking way. And I'm grateful for your time today. I'm really grateful for the opportunity to be on the podcast. I think you're doing a great job. I'd love listening in. I've reached out to some of your previous guests as well, just on a follow on LinkedIn, Instagram and stuff, just because I genuinely think, you know, you've got a great way of bringing those stories out of people. So I've really enjoyed it. Thank you. Super grateful for having me on.
That's made my day, Kieran. I really appreciate you saying that. Yeah, I like to try and bring these stories to life. So if I've done that, then that's my job accomplished in many ways. So yeah, what a lovely note to end it on. To everyone listening, hope you've enjoyed this as much as I have. And until next time, we'll speak again very, very soon. Do take care. Hey, hey. So outsourcing to a virtual assistant for less than $5 an hour has been a game changer for me. My VA living in Vietnam is, for one, a lovely human being, and two, she saves me so much time every single week since we started working together in May 2020. She produces these episodes, she edits audio, she sends emails to guests, she creates social media posts, she writes show notes, completes ad hoc tasks, and we spend less than 1 hour a week communicating over Zoom and email. Pretty dreamy, am I right? Well, I now share all these systems, insights, and mistakes I've made in my very first Udemy course, so you too can outsource to a virtual assistant and save over 10 plus hours a week. Since launching in November 2020, over 80 students have enrolled, and the course has received over 20 five-star ratings. To find out more, check out the link in my show notes where you can get an exclusive discount, or visit udemy.com/course/outsource-2-a-virtual-assistant. That's not easy to say. Let me just repeat that. That's udemy.com/course/outsource-2-a-virtual-assistant for more details.